This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 21st, 2019. Happy Easter. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The big deal feature. The Alberta election is over, the federal election is 6 months away, and the Mueller report on Donald Trump continues to be rated and debated. We catch up with Mario Canseco of Research Co. And The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is there something wrong in the Vancouver Whitecaps organization? The Major League Soccer club attracted international attention on April 17th. The Southsiders supporters group protested the club's timid handling of allegations by members of the 2007 and 2008 women's team against their coach. The Whitecaps and coach Bob Berarda went their separate ways in October 2008. The reason was not given then, but now former players say it was because of allegations of harassment and bullying. Berarda was recently suspended from coaching a teenage girls' team, but he has not commented. The former players accused the Whitecaps of sweeping the 2008 matter under the rug after ignoring their pleas for help. Whitecaps fans have accused the team of expressing indifference. The club has released three prepared statements so far, but none have been signed. It is as if nobody in front office or ownership wants to take charge, deal with the problem, and take steps towards reconciliation with the players affected. The former player leading the campaign is Kira McCormick, who accused President Bob Leonarduzzi of breaching her confidentiality when she came to him as a whistleblower in 2007. There have been several clouds over the men's Whitecaps organization in recent years. There was at least one arrest of a player for domestic assault. Another player was present at a party where a teenage athlete died. A reserve team player was arrested for harassing a waitress. Two members of the youth team were charged with sexually assaulting a teammate. The club's executive chairman, John Furlong, was accused of abusing gym class students from 4 decades ago. The Aboriginals, who are now adults, are not satisfied with the RCMP investigation that resulted in no charges. The allegations against Furlong have not been tested in court, but Furlong did withdraw defamation lawsuits against the Georgia Strait and writer Laura Robinson, who exposed the former Olympic executive's scandal in 2012. There is only silence from the top. Principal owner Greg Kerfoot. He bought the Whitecaps in 2002, but he has stayed away from cameras and microphones. All of this from an organization that uses the four-word slogan, Our all, our honor. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Star Online, Clarissa Chung reports, Dr. M announces revival of Bandar Malaysia Project. The project was announced under the administration of former Prime Minister Najib Razak in 2011 at a cost of $64.6 billion. The 486-acre project was previously linked to the controversial One Malaysia development scandal and was supposed to host the terminus of high-speed rail. In December 2015, the Finance Ministry sold off a 60% stake in Bandar Malaysia to a consortium consisting of Iskandar Waterfront Holdings and China Railway Engineering Corp. In May 2017, however, the government called off the deal. In the New Zealand Herald, we lived on a floating houseboat and now Thailand wants us killed. Thai authorities have raided a floating home in the Andaman Sea belonging to an American man and his Thai partner, who sought to be pioneers in the seasteading movement, which promises living in international waters to be free of any nation's laws. Thailand's Navy said Chad Elwartowski and Suprani Tepedet endangered national sovereignty, an offense punishable by life imprisonment or death. The couple, who have gone into hiding, had been living part-time on a small structure they said was anchored outside Thailand's territorial waters, just over 12 nautical miles from shore. They were not there when the Navy carried out the raid. Seasteading has had a revival in recent years as libertarian ideas of living free from state interference, such as by using cryptocurrency, including Bitcoin. Elwartowski, an IT specialist, has been involved in Bitcoin since 2010. And in the Anchorage Daily News, James Brooks reports, Ghost Hunters' hopes for board appointment busted by the Alaska legislature. The Alaska legislature voted April 17th against the appointment of a Wasilia man to the state's Violent Crimes Compensation Board after lawmakers said they were concerned about his ghost hunting hobby. John Francis is a founding member of Alaska Ghost Hunting and has occasionally appeared on television programs. He also administrates two large anti-crime Facebook groups, Stolen in Alaska and Mat Valley Crime Discussion. Lawmakers met for nearly 8 hours in a joint session to consider confirmation of more than 100 appointees to state boards, commissions, and the governor's cabinet. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Seattle PI, Zasha Millman reports, Seattle real estate is expensive unless you've got that Seahawks QB money. Russell Wilson broke records with his $140 million four-year contract extension plus a $65 million signing bonus. To put that money in perspective, real estate site Redfin took a look on their blog at exactly how much $205 million can buy in the greater Seattle metro area. For instance, Wilson lives with his family on the shores of Lake Washington in Bellevue, in an estate that cost $6.7 million, at least when he bought it in 2015. Even still, Redfin calculates that Wilson could buy up every home for sale in his West Bellevue neighborhood in cash. Meanwhile, Ben Arthur reports that Key Arena in Seattle is to cost at least $900 million to renovate, and completion is now expected in summer 2021. The privately financed project for a new NHL team and possibly NBA team was initially believed to cost around $600 million with a completion date of October 2020. In Czech news, Ben O'Hara Byrne reports, BC Ferries Howe Sound Queen sails into the sunset and onto the auction block. The Howe Sound Queen is getting set to sail off into the sunset, and she could be yours for a bargain. The 74-meter-long ferry continues to serve the Crofton to Vesuvius route, but BC Ferries will retire the vessel on June 1st. Now, a little more than a decade after a multi-million-dollar retrofit to extend her life, the 55-year-old ship is up for auction. According to the website govdeals.ca, the current top bid is $12,500. And last week in the Breaker.News, we brought you these headlines. UBC spends millions of dollars on ads to counter negative headlines. Watchdogs question loophole that allows SNC-Lavalin VP to lobby secretly in BC. And Squamish Nation and West Bank foresee condo lease sales in Burrard Bridge Towers plant. Read those stories behind the headlines in the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Welcoming back a regular guest, Mario Canseco of Research Co. here in Vancouver. Vancouver pollster who has his finger on the pulse of Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada. This week we saw change in Alberta, change back to what Alberta is used to. However, Alberta is not used to actually having an election race. Rachel Notley and the NDP were defeated after one term by Jason Kennedy and the United Conservatives. He united the right and was able to get the vote out and win the election in Alberta, which wasn't a surprise in the grand scheme of things. But were there any surprises on election night in Alberta that you spotted?
Well, I think the magnitude of the victory was something that was not properly predicted by anybody. I think, you know, we saw a situation, especially at the final stages, where the race definitely became more in favor of the United Conservative Party. The survey that I conducted, they were up, the NDP was down. So you saw a trend there that was going to be shown on election day as far as a victory for the party. But they did remarkably well. Getting to 55% of the vote is not something that you see every day. I think it's definitely shows that the strategy to unite the two parties worked very well. The share of the vote for the NDP is a little bit lower than it was in the last election. But we need to remember that this is a party that is used to getting 10, 11, maybe 14% of the vote, depending on the election that they contest. And now we're moving into a very clear two-party system. Nobody else elected anybody. You have the NDP as the center-left option and the UCP as the center-right or right option. So it's starting to look a lot like the United States, which is something that many people in Alberta will like.
Now, Jason Kenney rode to victory in his blue pickup truck. However, the road looks like it could be bumpy in front of him because there are problems behind him. The leadership campaign, the integrity of the leadership campaign, there are some complaints to the RCMP and to the Alberta Elections Regulator on that, which could distract Jason Kenney from fulfilling all the populist promises that he floated during this election campaign.
Well, it is kind of a similar situation to what we see with Donald Trump in the United States. I think the base that supports Jason Kenney and that voted so widely for him is not going to care about this situation unless it becomes a matter that involves the RCMP directly, or where we see some sort of situation where there is a trial or where there are charges involved. So in that sense, I don't think that is going to change the way in which voters who supported Jason Kenney feel about him. It might give the NDP an opportunity to say this never should have happened, you should have considered things, and it'll certainly make the first few months of his tenure bumpier than what is expected for somebody to get such a mandate from residents. But I think it also helps to look into the way this whole campaign was framed. I think it was more an opportunity for the NDP to talk about their economic management and certain things that they have done well, and less about social issues. A lot of voters thought that they were going to be moved by the social issues and the statements that certain candidates from the UCP have made, and it didn't really make a dent. So something to look forward to in the next federal election. If we turn this into a referendum about personalities and something you said 10 years ago or something you wrote in Facebook 5 months ago, economic matters are going to win if you go with a campaign that is based mostly on certain things that somebody might said and might have offended a specific group.
Now, Kenney has struck the fear into some in British Columbia, although not everyone, about his promise to enact the law to turn off the taps to stop the oil flowing in the existing Trans Mountain pipeline to British Columbia, which is opposed to the twinning of the Trans Mountain pipeline. Now, Jason Kenney is becoming the premier of the province of Alberta. He can't quite do the same things that, say, the leader of Venezuela or Xi Jinping in China or Kim Jong-un can do in North Korea and snap their fingers and command. This is not a command economy, and there's some economic reasons why that's just not feasible, especially since there's Alberta companies that operate in British Columbia that will need the fuel to get back to Alberta, WestJet, for instance.
Absolutely.
Can he keep his promises?
Well, I think it's a way in which he connected with the base in Alberta. They've always had premiers who have been very contentious to anything that the federal government is doing. We look at Peter Lougheed, we look at Ralph Klein. There's always been this fight. There's always been this issue of it's us against Ottawa because they don't care about what we're doing. And I think he worked very hard to sell the idea that Rachel Notley and Justin Trudeau were on the same boat, and that by having somebody who was trying to be more diplomatic about the way Alberta should be dealt with within Confederation, Alberta wasn't getting anywhere. So I think he capitalized on that and sold the idea that he was going to be a fighter, that he was going to be somebody who was going to stand up to the federal government and to other governments across the country. Now, whether that is actually something that he can do is up for debate. We've seen boastful statements in campaigns, both from the left and the right, that don't really materialize on the first day of office. Barack Obama said, I'm going to close Guantanamo the first day in office. Never happened. Donald Trump said, I'm going to repeal Obamacare first day in office. Hasn't happened, at least not the way in which he wanted it to be. So I think it was more of a statement that was meant to galvanize the base, but it's not something rooted in a reality, and it can actually backfire if it becomes a situation where other people in other parts of the country are saying, well, this isn't going to get you anywhere, might as well negotiate and we'll try to see what happens. But it was a good way of him to distance himself from what Rachel Notley was doing, which was more diplomatic, and start to do something that was more boastful and that a lot of voters in Alberta got behind.
Now, here in British Columbia, the Kenny win was greeted by the BC Liberal opposition, who are really hanging their hat on the high gas prices to attack John Horgan, really going after the low-information voters. There are reasons why the prices of gas are so high, and it's not just because of taxes. They're feeling it in Washington State, they're feeling it in Oregon, they're feeling it in California with refinery shutdowns for maintenance that are making their way through the market. The BC Liberals recycled Blair Elkstrom this week. The NDP recycled Blair Elkstrom this week to put the former BC Liberal minister in charge of consultation around the caribou protection legislation upcountry. The BC Liberals are also pushing the situation in Maple Ridge. There's a lot of disinformation going on there when it comes to housing the homeless and temporary modular housing, which is what the NDP wants to do. The BC Liberal opposition just hasn't been able to really capture the imagination or harness opposition to the NDP on a critical mass.
No, I think it's been very difficult for them, particularly because they're still trying to figure out how to get that 3 or 4% of the electorate to move to their column. And it's difficult to do so when most of the voters are in urban areas, when the support for the NDP was highest in the Lower Mainland than it is in other parts. So it's almost like you're running two separate campaigns. You want to appeal to the, pickup truck driving resident who votes in the north and who usually votes BC Liberal. But you're also trying to talk about specific social issues that are not as appealing to those who live in the urban areas. So it's a delicate balance. And going back to the era when the NDP was running BC, it was happening at a time. It starts when the government in Ottawa was liberal, and then it started to change a little bit. I mean, there were PCs. We are essentially catching the tail end of the Brian Mulroney years. Then you get Kim Campbell, and then you get liberal governments. So there's been a history of the NDP dealing well with the liberal governments in Ottawa, and I think people might look at that and also recognize it. If we get to the next election, it's not going to be early necessarily. I think those days of believing that the next election in BC could happen at any point are gone at this stage. But it definitely sets up a situation where Andrew Wilkinson needs to define himself. And I don't think it's going to work well for him to be as close to Jason Kenney and then try to knock on doors in the urban areas of the province where most people don't like Jason Kenney.
There is an election federally scheduled for 6 months from now, October 21st. And after all these, the SNC-Lavalin scandal, which has just dragged on and on and on, we now have the federal government announcing that the Trans Mountain Pipeline decision will come June 18th, just 3 days before National Aboriginal Day. That won't sit well with some Aboriginal groups that are against this pipeline. There just is continuing clouds on the horizon, dark clouds on the horizon for Justin Trudeau. And one of your recent polls found that 1 in 4 Trudeau voters from 2015 is considering another option for 2019.
Yeah, I think it's a tough situation for them because under Michael Ignatieff, the Liberal Party only got 13% of the vote in British Columbia. It was negligible at best. They were only able to save a couple of seats, both of them in the city of Vancouver. They did remarkably well in 2015, partly because of Justin Trudeau's character and the things he was saying and the very good campaign that they ran in order to connect with the voters who were vacillating between getting rid of Stephen Harper and voting for the Tom Mulcair-led NDP. But this isn't a province that has embraced the Liberals. It has pockets where it does remarkably well. So in that sense, it's not really that far-fetched to look at a situation where the voter who supported the Liberals under Trudeau is now looking elsewhere because Trudeau isn't as bright, this bright, shiny object that he used to be just a few months ago. I think it's very detrimental for them in the sense of trying to find suitable candidates. There might not be as many people who want to run for the Liberal Party now that they have this issue with SNC-Lavalin. They don't have a candidate yet for Vancouver-Granville, which is also problematic. We don't know exactly what is going to be happening there. And it really plays a role into the geographical nature of the next election. I think they're looking at it more as something where they can get a lot of votes in Quebec and maybe get some seats that the NDP defended under Tom Mulcair back in 2011, even if they lose seats in Ontario or in Atlantic Canada or in British Columbia, and then they can squeak by with a minority government. That's the way in which they're looking at things right now.
Yeah, that SNC-Lavalin scandal sure does owe itself to the kind of treatment they have in the United States. You know, a special prosecutor should come in and take a look at what went on in the Prime Minister's office and all this lobbying by SNC-Lavalin and all the behind-the-scenes intrigue to sort this out, because we're no closer to clarity on what exactly happened and whether any laws were broken. Meanwhile, in the United States, there was a special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. His report was finally published, redactions and all. Donald Trump continues to trumpet his no obstruction, no collusion, but the Mueller report isn't that simple. It shows that there definitely was a campaign by the Russians to interfere in the 2016 election, and that Trump was doing his best to try to obstruct the investigation into his campaign and into his presidency, but Mueller wasn't able to find that he actually crossed the line into the criminal territory.
Yeah, you know, I think part of the problem with this is the expectations from the non-Trump voter were always out of the ordinary when it came to the release of the report. They wanted something that said Trump colluded, this is what he did, we have proof, this was the meeting, this was the moment. And because the report doesn't have that, the Democrats feel a little dejected because they don't get anything that is going to be easy to pin on the current president of the United States. Donald Trump says everything's fine, there's no collusion, I haven't been accused of anything, so we can just continue. Now, I also think that this is just the start. It's just an opportunity for the Democrats to say, we want to read the whole thing, we want to know what is going on. We don't want to deal with a situation where you're talking about other investigations that could be jeopardized if you show us the full thing. Nothing could be more important than the integrity of the office of the president. So we might see a situation in the next couple of months where bits and pieces of the report come out, and if there's something there that is more detrimental to Donald Trump, then we'll have a very different situation than him using Game of Thrones memes in order to say that he's innocent.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways. Yes, you can vote for Maxime Bernier if you really want as well. I get that. There's a broad range of choices out there. We have a range of choices that you're going to be able to make, but it is a choice. It is a choice about the kind of future you want, about the kind of path you want Canada to be on.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Burnaby Center for Mental Health and Addiction, where it offers clients a wrap and recovery program. It's another way for people to use art for therapy to overcome substance abuse. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for April 21st, 2019. Happy Easter. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on April 21st in 1962, Seattle's World's Fair, the Century 21 Exposition, opened?
Everybody's planning to see Seattle's spectacular $100 million World's Fair.
So pack up your troubles and forget your cares. Pack up your family and head for the fair in Seattle.
It counted 6.6 million visitors to the fairgrounds, and legacies include the Space Needle, Pacific Science Center, and Key Arena. The fair featured live telecasts of The Ed Sullivan Show, appearances by Ray Bradbury and Rod Serling, and it was the setting of the Elvis Presley movie It Happened at the World's Fair. The Lancers recorded the official theme song, See You in Seattle.
Ride to a star.
Pack up your troubles wherever you are.
See you in Seattle. See you at the fair.
Take away a head look at tomorrow, just as if you were there. Take a rocket trip to Mars, have your dinner way up in the clouds.
Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.